27-year-old Brian Schaefer was a second-year med student at The Ohio State University. Life seemed to be going according to plan. He was 2 years away from becoming a doctor, he was dating a beautiful woman, and had plans to take a vacation with her to Miami. Tragedy struck when his mother, Renee, passed away from cancer, and though it was a heavy blow to the family, it did work to bring Brian closer to his father, Randy, and his brother, Derek. Brian took the loss hard and confided to friends and his girlfriend, Alexis, that he was struggling with it more than they knew. Just over 3 weeks later, Brian was preparing for spring break and the trip to Miami. He went out to dinner with his father and offered him support, telling him that he'd always be there for him. Alexis went out of town to visit her family, and Brian planned a night of bar hopping with his best friend, Clint Florence. Derek was invited, but due to other plans was unable to attend. On March 31st, 2006, Brian and Clint began at the Ugly Tuna Saluna in Columbus, Ohio, working their way up and down North High Street amid a flood of college students partying on the first day of their spring break. Sometime around midnight, Brian and Clint ran into Meredith Reed, who gave them a ride back to the Ugly Tuna Saluna and shared a drink with them. Surveillance cameras captured Brian standing outside the bar at 1:55 a.m., talking to two women. He walked back into the bar and apparently vanished into thin air. Neither Clint nor Meredith can account for his whereabouts at that point, and when the bar closed down a few minutes later, Brian was not amongst the crowd exiting. Family and friends became worried, notifying the police that Brian had disappeared. Investigators pored over hundreds of hours of security cameras from the Ugly Tuna as well as surrounding businesses and could find no signs of Brian. He never returned to his apartment, his car was never touched, and to this day there has been no activity on his bank account or social security number. Devastated, Alexis and Brian's family worked hard to drum up support for his cause, building a website and putting up flyers everywhere they could. Alexis called his cell phone every night, but always got his voicemail. Strangely, despite his support early on, Clint Florence quickly hired a lawyer and refused to take a polygraph test, making Brian's family question whether or not Clint knew where Brian was, or worse, had taken part in a crime which had led to Brian's disappearance. Over the years, speculation has run rampant about the smart and handsome med student who walked into a bar and never walked back out. Then one night, Alexis called Brian's cell phone and it rang. The phone was not equipped with GPS, but police were able to ping the tower nearby, and his phone appeared to be in a Columbus suburb, but they were never able to locate it or figure out why it rang that particular night. 11 years later, the police have no better idea of what happened to Brian than they did the night he vanished. In all of those years, there were never any new clues or any confirmed sightings. Neither Brian, his wallet, keys, or cell phone have ever been located. Tragically, 2 years after Brian vanished, his father Randy was killed in a freak accident during a storm, leaving Derek as the last member of his family and the man who would take up the mantle of searching for Brian. What happened to Brian Schaefer? Did he ever leave the Ugly Tuna that night, or is it possible that his body remains concealed within? Did a stranger accost him in a robbery gone wrong and dispose of his body? Was Brian, still struggling with the loss of his mother, desperate to get away and therefore executed a masterful disappearing act? Did Brian, so heartbroken and sunken into depression, choose to take his own life? Or does someone close to Brian know exactly what happened to him and has chosen to hide the truth for all of these years? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 24, The Disappearance of Brian Schaefer. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode looks into one of the most baffling disappearances in American history. Brian Schaefer was a brilliant young man with a promising future, and then one night, he vanished amid a crowd of partying college students and was never heard from again. This case has garnered national attention and remains a perplexing riddle for which there is no easy answer. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on missing persons and unsolved murders. We are available across multiple platforms and on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and many more. Trace Evidence has a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. It can be found at patreon.com/traceevidence. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you enjoy it and wish to help support it, please check out the Patreon page. I've also set up a one-time PayPal donation link on the main website for those of you who wish to contribute but don't want to use Patreon. Links, information, and more items, including YouTube videos and full episode transcripts, can be found on the website at trace-evidence.com. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Tweet me at traceevpod, that's TRACEEVPOD. Add me on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence Podcast or clicking the direct link on the website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. As a final note, if you enjoy the show, please rate and review it on whatever app or platform you're listening on. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the easier it becomes to find the podcast, and the more attention can be given to the cases that I cover. Today I look into the disappearance of Brian Schaefer. I've followed this case for a long time, and while I usually try to stick to cases with less attention, this has been highly requested by listeners, and it's a case that absolutely confounds everyone who digs into it. This is episode 24, The Disappearance of Brian Schaefer. Brian Randall Schaefer was born on February 25, 1979, in Pickerington, Ohio. Pickerington is a small suburb of Columbus, the capital city, with a total size of 9.74 square miles and a population of just over 18,000. He was the oldest son of Randy and Renee Schaefer, having a younger brother named Derek. Brian was a popular kid, intensely smart, and found it easy to make friends. His drive and determination was recognized early on with his sharp focus on academics and an ambition to achieve more. Brian is described as being 6'2" tall and weighing approximately 165 pounds. He has light brown hair and hazel eyes. Distinguishing marks are noted as a tattoo of a Pearl Jam symbol on his upper right arm and a small black dot which is present in the iris of his left eye. When last seen, Brian was wearing an olive-green short-sleeve polo shirt over a white long-sleeve shirt, blue jeans, white Adidas shoes, and a rubber yellow cancer awareness bracelet. Brian would go on to graduate from Pickerington High School in 1997, where he had previously been captain of the tennis team, heading on to The Ohio State University for his undergraduate work. He worked part-time for JCPenney from 1997 to January of 2002, after which he took a break to focus on his studies. In 2003, he obtained a bachelor's degree in microbiology, began working for Ohio State University Hospital as a radiology tech assistant, and after a short break from school, became a medical student at Ohio State University College of Medicine in 2004. Sadly, during his second year of med school, Brian's mother Renee passed away after a battle with myelodysplasia, a rare form of cancer. Brian was heartbroken by the loss and found himself in the difficult situation of pursuing a career in the medical field while watching his mother succumb to the terrible disease. Following her passing, Brian posted on his MySpace page saying, quote, "My mom was the greatest, most wonderful person in the world," end quote. Close friends said that Brian put on a strong face for his family, but internally was having a hard time accepting the loss, and that it was extremely painful for him. Despite his drive and focus, there was a side to Brian that only close friends were aware of. Being a med student is an extremely challenging position full of long nights, little sleep, and endless study. But for Brian, his true dreams existed somewhere in the relaxed lifestyle of tropical island living. He reportedly told friends that he would love to be living on a tropical island somewhere, playing in a band, and running his own bar. He made references to Jimmy Buffett and Margaritaville, and would sometimes say that medical school was simply for the time being, but his ultimate goals in life couldn't be achieved inside the walls of a university. Despite this image of himself in a Hawaiian shirt, strumming along on his guitar near a sandy beach, Brian had things which kept him close to home. On his MySpace page, Brian described himself, quote, "I'm a second-year medical student at Ohio State University, only 2 years to go. I have an awesome and amazing girlfriend. She's super hot and lots of fun. I really love music, and this whole doctor thing is really just a job, only temporary, until I get my band together and put out a record. I want to own an island someday, or at least a beach, so I can listen to Buffett all day and drink margaritas with my senorita," end quote. Brian had begun dating fellow med student Alexis Wagoner. According to Alexis, quote, "I thought he was cute, and one of my friends told him at a concert, and then he called and asked me if I wanted to go have dinner and study, and that's how it started," end quote. According to Alexis, the relationship was going smoothly. They had met one another's parents, spent a great deal of time together, and were highly supportive during the trials and tribulations of trying to balance medical school and a personal life. According to Alexis, after Renee passed away, Brian admitted to her that he was really struggling with the loss. He was in a dark place, and suggested to her that she may be happier with someone else. However, Alexis had said that this was a result of his depression about his mother's passing, and that he was able to pull himself out of it, and things between the two got back to the bright and happy place they had been previously. Actually, things began to become more serious between them. Brian purchased tickets for he and Alexis to take a trip to Miami. They were meant to fly out on Monday, April 3rd, 2006. Friends close to Brian have said that he planned to propose to Alexis while on vacation with her, but sadly, the flight would come and go, and neither Alexis nor Brian would be on it. Friday, March 31st, was the last day of classes for Brian before spring break started. Brian was looking to celebrate. Spring break was finally here, and he had his trip to Miami with Alexis all set to go after the weekend. But that weekend in particular was going to be about having fun with friends and family, celebrating his achievements, and just all-around good times. He met his father, Randy, for dinner early in the evening. The two traveled to Reynoldsburg to an Outback steakhouse, and Randy described his son as seeming very positive. According to Randy, he was still struggling with the loss of his wife, and Brian was there for him. Randy would later say, quote, "He seemed to be in pretty good spirits as far as that, and he gave me more comfort that night than I might have given him. I got the same thing that my wife and I had gotten for a long time there, and it kind of saddened my heart. I started to shed a few tears, and he said, 'It's all right, Dad. I'll be with you as much as I can,'" end quote. Brian was very supportive of his father. It had only been 3 weeks since his mother had passed away, and the tragic loss, though devastating, had brought Brian, his father, and his brother Derek closer together. Randy was proud of his son, but was also concerned about him. Brian had just come out of a long run of cramming for exams, and he looked tired. Randy would later say, quote, "He would study maybe 2 o'clock till 8 or 9 in the morning. He was a night owl. He wasn't getting much sleep," end quote. Brian told Randy that he had plans to go out that night, and though Randy understood his son's desire to celebrate and enjoy his time off, he couldn't help but feel like Brian may have benefited more from staying in and resting. Despite his hesitation about it, Randy figured that Brian was mature and a dependable man, and that he shouldn't worry too much about it, and so he elected not to push the issue, a decision he would later regret. Brian had made plans earlier to go out with his good friend and former dorm roommate William Florence, better known as Clint. His girlfriend at the time, Alexis, was out of town for the weekend, visiting her parents in Toledo, though she was very excited about the vacation they had planned together. Flying solo that weekend, Brian saw it as the perfect opportunity for a guy's night out, so he and Florence planned to go to the Ugly Tuna Saluna located at 1546 North High Street in Columbus, not far from where Brian was enrolled in medical school. The Ugly Tuna was an upstairs bar located in the South Campus Gateway, and was a popular spot for students. North High Street was the center of nightlife for local university students, but on this particular weekend, with spring break beginning, the streets were flooded, and the local bars and restaurants that dotted the avenue were chock full of partiers. It was a cool night, Though the bitterness of winter seemed to be subsiding, and coats were cast aside for long sleeves, though it wasn't quite warm enough for shorts. Brian and Florence arrived at the bar at approximately 9 p.m. Brian invited his brother Derek and his girlfriend Marin along for the night out. Derek was interested, but he and Marin had plans to attend a show at a comedy club, the Funny Bone. Derek thought perhaps he and Marin could attend afterwards, but when the show ended, they were both feeling tired. Asked about this later, Derek stated, quote, "We were trying to meet up. I'd been to a comedy club in Columbus, but it was late. Marin, my girlfriend, and I headed back to where I lived and met with friends at a local bar instead," end quote. Derek can't help but feel like if he would have made different choices that night, his brother might still be safe and sound. In an interview, he later said, quote, "I've thought about that night over and over and over for 10 years. What if I had been there that night? Would things have been different? Would my brother still be here? I've carried that guilt around for a while," end quote. At approximately 10 p.m., Brian placed a call to Alexis. According to reports of the time, Brian expressed how much he missed her and loved her. He told her that he was excited and looking forward to spending the next week with her in Miami. The two said goodnight, and Brian explained that he was going to be doing some bar hopping with Clint Florence, and Alexis reminded him to give her a call the next day. This would be the last time Alexis would ever speak to Brian. Brian and Clint left the Ugly Tuna, headed down the street, and made a few stops along the way at other bars. It was a pub crawl, in a sense, with the two heading in and getting a shot or two before moving on to the next location, headed in the direction of the Arena District. In one particular bar, called the Short North, the two men ran into Florence's friend, Meredith Reed. Perhaps due to the time, or the crowd, Brian and Florence asked Reed if she would give them a ride back to the Ugly Tuna. It was nearing midnight, and Reed told them that would be fine, and in fact, she'd come in with them and have a drink. Surveillance camera footage later obtained by investigators clearly shows Brian, Florence, and Reed taking the escalator to the upstairs bar of the Ugly Tuna at 1:15 a.m. on Saturday, April 1st, 2006. From this point forward, surveillance footage becomes important as a witness to the events of this evening. Surveillance footage captured images of Brian at 1:55 a.m., standing at the top of the escalators talking to two women who Clint would later identify as classmates from Ohio State. At this point, Brian turns around and walks back into the bar, and the trio discussed heading home, feeling pretty dumb with the night's events. Reed and Florence would later tell police, sometime after Brian re-entered, they became separated from him. According to Reed, quote, "Clint and Brian were talking about something, and Brian mentioned he was going up, like, toward the stage area," end quote. This was the last time either Reed or Clint report seeing Brian. As the bar began closing up, Reed and Clint say they looked all over for Brian, but were unable to find him. There was a large mass of people now traveling towards the doors, as last call had passed. Clint and Reed, at this point, assume that Brian may have met up with other friends or taken a cab home, and so they left, not thinking much else about it. It wasn't uncommon for friends to get separated when out drinking in such a crowd, and Brian was a responsible guy who had never had any issues before, so they didn't think too much about it. The Ugly Tuna officially closed at 2 a.m. Strangely, there is no surveillance footage of Brian leaving the bar that night, which to this day absolutely baffles investigators. No one was aware of Brian's disappearance at first. Brian's father, Randy, placed several calls to his cell phone that weekend, but received no answers. Alexis also called for Brian, but she too was unable to get him on the phone. She was coming back into town and still very much looking forward to their vacation, so she headed over to his apartment, but could find no sign of him. She spent the weekend in his apartment waiting for him to return, and her fear and nervousness grew exponentially every time she dialed his number and failed to get an answer. Finally, Alexis called Randy and told him of the situation. Alexis would later state, quote, "I was kind of starting to worry Saturday night, and by Sunday morning, when I hadn't heard anything, I was really thinking there was something wrong," end quote. Concerned, though not yet frightened, Randy placed a call to Brian's brother Derek and told him that Brian might be missing. Derek's first thought was that Brian had spent the weekend partying and was staying over a friend's place. He even harbored the possibility that the whole thing was just a prank Brian was playing on them. It was, after all, the weekend of April Fool's Day. When asked about the call, Derek stated, quote, "Dad said Brian was missing. He asked if I could go to his apartment and see if he was there, so I drove to his place. The lights were on, so I thought, oh good, he's back home. But Alexis was there, not Brian. That's when we knew something was up. No one had talked to him since Friday night." End quote. According to Alexis and Derek, Brian's car was still parked in its space near his apartment, and nothing had been disturbed on the inside. There was no sign to suggest that Brian had ever come home. When Monday came and went, with Brian never contacting anyone and now missing the flight to Miami, Randy Schaefer contacted the Columbus police to report his son missing. Police began their investigation by talking to friends and family and going to the Ugly Tuna. A combined reward was quickly put together, with $2,000 supplied by Crime Stoppers and another $5,000 from the Ohio State University College of Medicine and Public Health. While police were conducting the initial stages of their investigation, Brian's friends and family began covering campus and surrounding streets with flyers advertising his disappearance. When asked about whether or not foul play may be involved in the disappearance, police were hesitant to speculate. Talking about Brian and Alexis, Sergeant Mike Wood stated, quote, "Everything was set up for these two to take this trip to Florida. That's what makes this unusual." End quote. Police took copies of surveillance footage from the Ugly Tuna, as well as conducting door-to-door canvassing of the surrounding area. Randy Schaefer brought in search dogs to assist in the effort, and while they initially hit on what may have been Brian's scent, they were unable to follow it anywhere and did not hit on it again. Little came from the police's questioning, and Sergeant John Hurst, who would lead the investigation, stated early on, quote, "So far, the leads we've really taken haven't taken us too far. We have a few leads that we're still working on that we haven't fully developed. Once those develop, hopefully, they'll give us some directions." End quote. In a plea to the public, Randy Schaefer said, quote, "He means so much to me. I lost my wife. I don't want to lose my son, too. Please help me find him." End quote. Police searches intensified. They searched every dumpster and waste receptacle in the large area surrounding the Ugly Tuna, and were even granted permission by the city to go down into the sewers, and still came up empty-handed. Early on in the investigation, police seemed to be curious about the accounts given to them by Meredith Reed and Clint Florence, the last two people to have seen Brian that night. They weren't sure if they could possibly know more than they were saying, or who may have been involved, and so they issued a round of polygraph tests. Brian's father Randy volunteered and was tested and passed. Meredith Reed also submitted to a test and passed. On the other hand, Brian's best friend Clint, who initially was very open to assisting investigators, refused to submit to a polygraph test and quickly hired a lawyer, through whom all future communication with police would be conducted. This behavior set off some red flags for friends and family, particularly Brian's brother Derek, who later said, quote, "I don't know Clint very well, but I always thought something was off with him. The way he talked about my brother after he went missing, kind of in a negative way. I wouldn't expect that from someone whose friend vanished. If Clint knew something, I hope he would have shared it. I deserve to know." End quote. Clint's lawyer, Neil Rosenberg, when asked about why his client appeared to be concealing information from the police, responded strongly. In an email, Rosenberg said, quote, "The only burning issue with the authorities remains Clint's refusal to be polygraphed. That decision was based on my recommendation and advice to Clint, not because he is, has been misleading, or has something to hide, but that he simply has nothing new to tell and was totally upfront and honest with them from the beginning. As far as Clint is concerned, this matter is closed." End quote. Many have taken issue with Clint's position, feeling that if he truly had nothing to hide, he would be more open and helpful. He refused polygraph tests on two separate occasions. "I've been fairly open with my feelings on polygraph tests in the past, from their validity to their necessity, but public opinion does tend to shift when someone refuses one, even if legally that is the more logical choice." Alexis was devastated by Brian's disappearance, and spent a great deal of time both in his apartment and putting up flyers everywhere she could. She called his cell phone frequently, leaving him messages or just to feel like he was still within reach. As the investigation developed further, leads were becoming few and far between. Police examined the camera footage from the Ugly Tuna, though they couldn't quite figure out how they could watch Brian enter the bar at 1:55 a.m. and then never exit. They considered the possibility that he may have slipped by the cameras, though this seemed unlikely. Grasping at straws, they theorized he could have changed his clothes or put on a hat to conceal his face and have left, but that would suggest he was planning to disappear, and investigators did not think that was likely the case, though it had to be considered. Police were able to account for and identify nearly every individual seen leaving the Ugly Tuna that night, except for Brian. The two women he was seen speaking with that night were later identified as Brighton Zatko and Amber Ruick. When asked about Brian, Ruick didn't have any ideas and told reporters that she had never been asked to take a polygraph. Police were absolutely baffled by Brian's disappearing act. There was a service freight elevator, which could have been taken as an exit, that wasn't under surveillance. Investigators initially thought he could have left via that method, but as their search expanded, they began reviewing surveillance footage from all surrounding businesses. Columbus has the most surveillance cameras of any city in the state of Ohio, more than Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Toledo combined, and yet they could find no signs of Brian. One of those cameras had a clear shot of the freight elevator exit, and Brian never appeared anywhere on it. Strangely, a month after Brian disappeared, Alexis received a phone call from police. In May, someone had broken into Brian's apartment, and they needed her to come down and identify any items which may have been missing. As a result of their investigation into the break-in, police were able to determine that there was no connection between the crime and Brian's disappearance, and was likely committed by someone who had noticed the apartment seeming vacant. Brian's father, Randy, set up a website, findbrianshafer.com, in hopes of getting more tips or information about his disappearance. Later in the month, a Pearl Jam concert happened in Cincinnati, and Brian had previously purchased tickets. Alexis couldn't bring herself to go, so she auctioned the tickets off on eBay and added the money to his reward. Eddie Vedder, the frontman for Pearl Jam, read off Brian's description during the show and dedicated a song to him. I'm gonna play a short clip of Vedder talking about Schaefer during the concert.
Last April, a young man named Brian Schaefer kind of went missing. He looks like he's in his 20s. He's 6'2", real handsome guy. And he's got a Pearl Jam tattoo on his upper right arm.
A few psychics came forward claiming to have information regarding Brian's disappearance. Bill Mitchell alleged to have a vision of Brian and stated, quote, "When I saw his picture Monday night, I immediately tuned into him and felt he'd been drinking too much over the weekend. He's gone through a recent tragedy. His mother's passed away. I think he was just a little too drunk to really make it home safely. I feel positive that he's alive, but I feel there has been an injury. I keep feeling impact in my abdomen," end quote. Despite the efforts of so-called psychics, no new information was gleaned, and the case quickly became a startling mess of theories with no supporting evidence. Not a single shred of evidence could be found to suggest what could have happened to Brian that night. His keys, wallet, and cell phone were never recovered. Detective Andre Edwards dedicated hundreds of hours to watching and re-watching footage from the Ugly Tuna that night. On several occasions, he thought he had spotted Brian exiting, But each time he showed the footage to friends and family, enlarged and sharpened, they were unable to confirm that it was Brian. When asked about Brian's movements that night, Edward stated, quote, "I can say with 100% certainty that Brian Schaefer did not go back down that escalator," end quote. Cadaver dogs were brought into the bar to investigate the possibility that Brian had been murdered or possibly died and was somewhere inside the bar. There were no hits. Police began monitoring Brian's cell phone as well as his bank accounts, but there has not been any activity on either to suggest that Brian was still alive. Police had two essential theories from the get-go. One was that Brian had chosen to leave town. They considered information from his friends and family about the difficulty he'd been going through since losing his mother, and his dream of living on an island somewhere. Despite this possibility, they couldn't help but suspect foul play was involved, though they wouldn't discuss what specifically made them lean this way, other than the fact that Brian had made future plans and was unlikely to abandon his family during such a difficult time. Days began changing into weeks, and weeks into months, without any sight nor hope of locating Brian. Alexis continued her daily routine of placing calls to his cell phone and immediately getting his voicemail. Then, in September, one of her calls was met with the sound of ringing. The phone rang a total of 3 times before sending her to voicemail. She called back, wanting to hear the sound again. She later wrote on her MySpace page, quote, "I kept calling it to hear it purely because it was one of the best sounds I have ever heard, even if no one picked up," end quote. Brian's cell phone was on the Cingular network, and they had 2 possible reasons as to why his phone may have rang. They suspected it could have been a glitch which allowed Alexis to hear a ring, though in reality it likely was not ringing. They also put forth the possibility that at that time, his phone may have been powered on. Unfortunately, Brian's phone wasn't equipped with GPS, making it impossible to get an exact location. The police were able to ping the tower and found that the call originated from Hillard, a town located 14 miles northwest of Columbus. Further investigation developed no new leads or information, and Brian's phone was never recovered. A psychic contacted Randy and told him that he believed Brian's body could be recovered from a river somewhere beneath a bridge. As a result of this, friends and family began conducting searches of rivers in the area. Police joined in, searching several rivers, but were unable to find anything pointing them in the proper direction. A theory began to develop that Brian's disappearance may in some way be connected to the smiley face murder theory. In short, the smiley face theory suggests that several bodies discovered in waterways around the Midwestern United States were not the result of accidental drowning, but were actually victims of murder. Graffiti was typically located within close proximity to the bodies depicting a smiley face. For the most part, this theory is dismissed as pure speculation, and smiley faces are an extremely common form of graffiti. A year after Brian's disappearance, friends and family began planning a prayer vigil in memorial of him in hopes of bringing the community together and possibly generating some leads. In mid-March, prior to the vigil, police recovered skeletal remains 60 miles away from where Brian had vanished. A man who was out in the woods collecting aluminum cans happened upon the remains and notified police. They were determined to be a year old. The family held their breath for 2 days as the remains were examined, but ultimately they turned out to be those of a female. The prayer vigil went forward, taking place outside of the Ugly Tuna. Friends and family gathered, saying prayers for Brian, hanging new flyers, and hoping beyond hope. Another year would pass, and in September of 2008, tragedy would once again strike the Schaefer family. A heavy storm swept through central Ohio, and Randy Schaefer was out in the yard cleaning debris. At approximately 6 p.m., a strong gust of wind knocked down a tree, and it struck Randy, killing him. His body was discovered the next day by a neighbor. In the course of just 3 years, Derek Schaefer had lost his mother to cancer, his brother had vanished, and then his father was killed in a freak accident. Randy's obituary appeared online, and someone commented on it, claiming to be Brian. The poster wrote, quote, "Dad, I love you. Love, Brian. U.S. Virgin Islands," end quote. Police immediately tracked down the IP address of the poster, and it was discovered to be a hoax. Shortly after Randy's passing, Clint Florence's lawyer, Neil Rosenberg, exchanged several emails regarding Brian's disappearance and Clint's disinterest in taking a polygraph. Rosenberg claimed to have spoken to several detectives working the case, and that they had allegedly suggested to him that Brian may still be alive. Rosenberg took this to mean that Brian had chosen to run off. In the emails, Rosenberg stated, quote, "If Brian is alive, which is what I am led to believe after speaking with the detective involved, then it is Brian and not Clint who is causing his family pain and hardship. Brian should come forward and end this," end quote. Derek Schaefer chose to respond, saying of Clint, quote, "As soon as detectives started getting involved, that's pretty much when he had no contact with anybody. I've always thought he definitely knows something, just won't come forward with it. If Brian did take off somewhere, if that is the case, we just always had a strong feeling Clint would possibly know that," end quote. No new leads or information have come to the surface in the 11 years since Brian disappeared, and those who loved him and miss him have been forced to move forward with their lives. Derek Schaefer moved away with his wife. He still works in Central Ohio and remains hopeful that someday he will have answers. Alexis Wagoner spent the better part of the first year waiting for Brian, hoping that he would return someday. Eventually, she boxed up his belongings and kept them in her closet, and finally had to let go and move forward with her life. She has since become an OBGYN, is married, and has two children. She still speaks out about Brian whenever possible, and has been a part of multiple media interviews. Sergeant Hurst, the lead investigator on the case, took it extremely personal, as did those who worked beneath him. Hurst, now the head of the Columbus Police Department's Physical Abuse Unit, stated, quote, "The detectives involved in this case became personally and emotionally involved. It's still a case we very much think about and talk about today," end quote. When asked if more than 10 years later, if he believes it's possible that Brian is alive, he responded, quote, "There is a possibility he is alive, but if you look at the probabilities that he isn't alive, those are just as great," end quote. When asked about whether or not he believed Brian was murdered, Hurst said, quote, "There is nothing we have been able to recover that shows he succumbed to foul play, so again, the probability of that isn't as great as he just walked away," end quote. Sadly, he concluded his statement by saying, quote, "The answers that everyone wants, everyone needs, I don't know if we will ever find them," end quote. Several theories have sprung up in the 11 years since Brian Schaefer walked into the Ugly Tuna Saluna and vanished into thin air. With such a strange disappearance, it would be even stranger if there weren't more than a few theories. The police have chosen not to reveal which theories they think are most strongly possible, but others have spoken out, including Brian's friends and family. The first theory, which always exists in cases where adults vanish, is that Brian Schaefer chose to walk away. Many point to his struggles with depression after the passing of his mother, his dreams of being on a tropical island someday, and his candid remarks to Alexis about moving on and finding someone who could make her happy. Some even believe that Clint Florence may know Brian's whereabouts. Another theory is that Brian didn't just walk away, but that he committed suicide. If indeed his depression had worsened, and he saw his life going in a direction that he didn't wish to pursue any longer, many believe it's entirely possible that he chose to take his own life. The fact that his body was never recovered makes others question the theory, but it cannot be ruled out completely. Some believe the very thin theory that Brian fell victim to the alleged smiley face killer. Aside from the fact that the theory has been rejected by law enforcement, and even the FBI, there are those who examine the cases with which it is associated and see the possibilities. A common theory is that Brian Schaefer fell victim to foul play of one form or another. Though the specifics are unknown, many speculate that his body is somewhere inside the Ugly Tuna. Despite exhaustive search efforts by police and the use of cadaver dogs, this is still a pretty popular theory amongst online detectives. Of course, how Brian met his end is another matter. Some speculate that Brian was accosted by a total stranger, while others believe it was someone he knew and trusted. Speculation has run rampant that Clint Florence was involved in the disappearance of Brian Schaefer. There have been rumors for years that Clint was involved in some kind of illegal activities, and that he and Brian were beginning to experience moments of tension surrounding these acts. Some have gone so far as to allege that, Following the loss of his mother, Brian became involved with Clint in some kind of illegal business, and when things went sideways, Clint chose to kill Brian and conceal his body. Clint's alleged involvement is only spurned on more by his lack of cooperation and refusal to take a polygraph. It has been over 11 years since Brian Schaefer vanished, and not a single piece of evidence has ever been recovered. Those who loved Brian have been forced to move forward, accepting that they may never have answers. A handsome, intelligent 27-year-old med student went out for a night of celebration, had plans for a dream vacation with the woman he was possibly going to propose to, and never came home. His father tragically died, never having known Brian's fate, and Derek remains the only member of his family to still live with the uncertainty. He wears a green bracelet with Brian's name on it to this day, hoping against all odds that he will one day find his brother, or at least discover what happened to him. A $25,500 reward is still being offered for information leading to Brian's whereabouts. Until someone comes forward, police come up with a break in the case, or Brian himself is found, the vanishing of Brian Schaefer remains one of the most mind-boggling and baffling disappearances in American history. Wouldn't it be great if there was a place to discover awesome discounts on gently used clothes? There is. Swap.com. Swap.com is the world's largest online consignment and thrift store. With Swap.com, you can save up to 90% off retail prices on your favorite brands like Lululemon, Carter's, Nike, J.Crew, and Gap. Between 6 to 10,000 new items added daily. If something doesn't fit, enjoy hassle-free returns within 30 days, no questions asked. I have a special offer for all Trace Evidence listeners. Using the promo code TRACE40, you will receive a 40% off store-wide discount for your first order, and free shipping is included. This offer is valid now through November 30th. Visit swap.com, and don't forget to use your promo code TRACE40 for some amazing deals. The disappearance of Brian Schaefer is one of the most well-known vanishings in American history. It's an incredibly baffling story. I know I personally spent a lot of time researching it, even before I knew I was going to cover it. The idea that a man can just vanish into thin air from inside of a bar surrounded by security cameras and nothing is ever found is as startling as it is tragic. What I've experienced with a lot of coverage on this case is an intense focus on what, but not nearly as much on the who, and I wanted to put Brian himself more in the spotlight. Obviously, what happened to him is incredibly important, but who he was, or is the real story. The Schaefer family was struck by a terrible string of tragedies. First, Renee Schaefer, Brian's mother, passed away after a short battle with cancer. Anyone who has ever been touched by this terrible disease has had to say goodbye to a loved one as they slowly fade, knows how incredibly heartbreaking it truly is. Brian was in med school when his mother passed away, and I can't even begin to imagine the pain he must have felt knowing that his mother was sick and he couldn't do anything to help her. Plus, with his knowledge of the disease, he likely knew more of what was happening to her on an anatomical level, more so than anyone else in her life. Despite that, he was there for her as much as he could be. She became his hero because of how hard she fought and how brave she was. As is often the case, tragedy can sometimes draw families closer together, and that is exactly what happened here. Derek, Brian's brother, has been very open about the fact that following the passing of his mother, Brian was in communication more often, and the two felt closer than they ever had. Renee passed away just 25 days before Brian vanished, striking yet another blow to the family who were already in mourning. 2 years after Brian went missing, his father Randy was tragically killed when a tree fell on him during a bad storm, leaving Derek as the sole remaining member of his family, and the one who would be left with the haunting question of what happened to his brother, a question which has yet to be answered. So what happened to Brian Schaefer? As many detectives have discovered, that's a much easier question to ask than it is to answer. There are several different theories that cover a wide array of possibilities, most of which are still debated on forums and websites all around the world. The first theory I'd like to focus on is one which is almost always present in cases where adults disappear, and that's the theory that Brian Schaefer chose to leave and that his disappearance was of his own doing. Much of this theory revolves around the loss of Brian's mother. Friends said that he was handling it, but that it was really hitting him harder than he was showing. Alexis has said before that, during that period, he made mention of breaking up. He was in a dark place and felt like she would be happier if she could find another guy who was more available to be the loving boyfriend. Between his mourning and his studies, there wasn't a lot of time for him to play the role of boyfriend. We also know, based on his MySpace page and statements that he made to friends, that Brian wasn't all about the doctor life. He saw it as a job, but not as a life. His dream was to be on a tropical island, maybe own a bar, play in a band, and just live a chill and relaxed lifestyle. Immediately following his disappearance, police considered that he may have gone somewhere like the Virgin Islands, someplace tropical in nature that he didn't need a passport to reach. Then there was the hoax comment on his father's obituary, which later made police feel like this was a viable theory until they discovered the truth. Even Brian's own family members, including Derek, have said that they didn't think it was completely impossible that he may have chosen to run off. It isn't hard to imagine that someone in his position might feel the need to escape for a little while. But there are several factors which I believe make this theory less likely. Firstly, Brian had plans for a trip to Miami with Alexis, with whom he had reconciled and apologized for his earlier words about breaking up. He was clearly in love with her, and a week's vacation in Miami sounded just like the kind of adventure he needed. In addition to this, he had just had dinner with his father, who he could see was struggling with the passing of his wife, and had assured him that he would be there for him as much as he possibly could be. I didn't know Brian, but from everything I've read, he certainly doesn't sound like the kind of man who would promise to be there if he knew he was going to leave. On top of all that, factor in that there has never been activity on Brian's social security number or bank account. Sure, it's possible that he ran off somewhere, had some loose cash available, and is making it, but it seems unlikely. The clincher for me is that, if Brian had run off, I find it hard to believe he would have maintained radio silence when his father passed away. Another thing which I think plays a role in this is that Brian's face has been plastered all over websites and news reports. There are copious amounts of news articles, special reports, and podcasts which have touched on this case. I think it's incredibly unlikely that he would be able to just disappear into the masses without someone having seen him by now. This isn't the 1950s, and vanishing by choice is nearly impossible these days unless you're willing to travel to a country where technology, like the internet, isn't as widespread. And even then, you're going to have a hard time being an American trying not to stand out. I can honestly understand thinking Brian had chosen to leave early on. After the first year or two passed, and with each subsequent year, I believe the possibility becomes less and less likely. I know there's been a lot of speculation about it, and some of which has come from Clint Florence's lawyer, which I'll address later, but I don't believe there is much evidence to suggest this is what happened. Frankly, there isn't much evidence, period. To believe that Brian chose to vanish, I think you have to look at it from a perspective that he planned it out. I sincerely doubt it was a spur-of-the-moment decision he made, because if it was, then he managed to pull it off flawlessly. But to play devil's advocate, let's assume he chose to leave. That means he did so without making any preparations that we know of. He wasn't bringing anything with him except for the clothes on his back. He would have had to have known a way around the Ugly Tuna security cameras, as well as the other hundreds of cameras in the area. He left his car behind, and public transportation wouldn't have been an option unless he could somehow conceal his identity. He would also have to have known that he was leaving behind an already devastated family and a loving girlfriend. I know that sometimes people make these decisions, and we've certainly seen instances where people have elected to disappear and successfully done so, but I simply don't see that in this case. Although it's possible, I do not believe that whatever happened to Brian was by his own choice. The second theory in this case is that Brian didn't run away, but instead committed suicide. Most of the logic behind this theory stems from the same place as the theory that he ran away: depression, feeling overwhelmed, The intense loss of his mother and his inability to accept that he was going to be a doctor, while his dream of being on an island sat on the back burner. Depression can overcome your senses, and people who are severely depressed often view suicide as the only way out. It doesn't matter how successful you are, or the way you're perceived from those in your life. We just recently saw two tragic suicides by famous musicians, which speaks volumes about how outward appearances can be deceiving. Brian appeared to be a happy-go-lucky, focused and dedicated med student with a bright future, which may have even included a pending engagement. Unfortunately, in many instances, that stuff doesn't matter as much as the pain a person is feeling and their sense of hopelessness. Factor in a lot of alcohol, and you've got a recipe for disaster. So is it possible? Absolutely. But there are several things which lead me to believe this wasn't the case. First and foremost is planning. Typically, someone who's in the mindset of committing suicide doesn't make future plans. This isn't always the case, but if someone is suffering from depression and doesn't want to commit to future events, it's often considered a warning sign. Brian did commit to future events, and he expressed excitement about them. Beyond that, Brian vanished from the ugly tuna that night. That seems like an extreme length to go to in order to commit suicide. Typically, suicidal people are not overly concerned about their bodies being discovered, at least not to the point that they will make sure it can't be. Brian's remains have never been recovered, which seems fairly unlikely in the case of a suicide. He could have jumped from a bridge, ended up in a river, and simply hasn't been found yet, but considering the lengths police and family went to search for his body, that also seems unlikely. Police have suggested that suicide has to be considered a possibility in this case. And when there's so little to go on, you probably have to consider every angle. Brian certainly could have committed suicide, but to me, that doesn't seem like the most likely scenario here. How does one make the decision to commit suicide and also manage to completely vanish from a very public bar? That's the part which makes me question everything. If he'd gone home that night and there was some record of it, and then he vanished, I'd think it was a little more probable, but the question of how he managed to disappear is what drives at the heart of this case. Is it possible that the police simply missed Brian, or that he did manage to sneak out via some way in which no surveillance camera in the entire city ever spotted him? Yes. But it's also highly unlikely. It's impossible to try and imagine the mindset of someone who has become suicidal. All of our instincts fight to make us survive, and many who have attempted suicide have admitted that they regretted it as soon as it began. It's impossible to know for sure, but I do not believe that Brian chose to commit suicide that night. There is a slim possibility that Brian may have died accidentally, as has been suggested by some, that he may have indulged in some illegal drugs and died as a result of those activities, and that whoever he was with disposed of his body. Though this is possible, I also find this unlikely. The final two theories address the possibility that Brian may have fallen victim to foul play. So there are two essential possibilities here: that Brian was killed by someone he knew or by a total stranger. Each of these has a subset: that Brian was killed in and left in the ugly tuna, or Brian was killed elsewhere. Approaching the first theory, that it was either someone Brian didn't know or that it was someone he didn't know well enough to call this person a stranger, there are several different roads that can be traveled. Though many believe that Brian never left the bar that night, this seems almost impossible. The police swept the bar with cadaver dogs on multiple occasions. They also processed for DNA and were unable to come up with anything signifying that a crime had been committed. Though it goes beyond my understanding, I don't believe that Brian was killed and left somewhere in that bar. Aside from the fact that there are only so many places you could hide a body in there, eventually the smell is going to get people's attention. Now, you could believe that maybe he was murdered inside and then dismembered and removed from the location, but that seems like the kind of thing you'd see in a movie, and not so much a likelihood in this reality. Plus, wouldn't some of the employees have noticed? So for me, the stranger theory has to involve Brian being outside the bar. Assuming Brian managed to leave the tuna that night without being captured on surveillance cameras, it seems most logical that he'd have been looking to get home. Separated from his friends and his ride, likely fairly intoxicated, he could have tried to hail a cab or possibly even walk back to his home. A disoriented man in a part of town that wasn't the clean and nice area it is today, Brian would have been vulnerable. We don't know how much money he carried that night, but the idea that someone murdered him as the result of a robbery gone wrong isn't something which can be dismissed out of hand. At least not entirely. The problem I have with this theory is, when someone is mugged on the street and mortally wounded, the suspect doesn't typically take the body with him. Yes, it's possible this took place near a river, and Brian could have been weighed down, but again, I believe his remains would have been recovered by now, and considering the large quantity of cameras in the area, they would have probably seen something. If robbery wasn't the motive, it could have been of a more personal nature. We know Brian talked to two women outside the bar shortly before he disappeared. It's entirely possible that one of them had a boyfriend or simply someone who was with them who didn't appreciate the attention Brian was giving them and chose to make a move. Factor in alcohol and possible drugs here, since you've got a lot of drunk and stoned college kids running around. Tempers can flare up pretty easily under those circumstances. Again, I hit the same wall though. How has his body never been recovered? Unfortunately, this is the detail which makes me question everything. I can't pretend to know all the ways in which someone could dispose of a body so that it's never found, but there was a construction site located near the Ugly Tuna. In fact, the freight elevator that was not being filmed led almost directly to it, though police would later say that a different business's camera shot that angle. I don't think it's impossible to assume that Brian could have been buried at the site, maybe in a space where there was a hole or some kind of area, and that it wouldn't be noticed before construction finished. It reminds me vaguely of the possibilities in the Kyle Fleischman case. Could Brian have been attacked and murdered, or possibly even abducted by a stranger? I believe so, but that's about where it ends. There's nothing else to suggest that there is any evidence of this, nor any hints about it. No one has ever talked, and typically in a situation like this, someone's going to open their mouth eventually. We've never heard from anyone, even the most remote hint, that Brian was murdered that night. There was the smiley face theory, but to me, that's one of those complex theories concocted without much evidence to support it. Also, it'd be impossible to link Brian to that theory, since his body was never recovered. I do believe that Brian could have been murdered that night, by someone he didn't know, and I consider that more likely than him choosing to run away or committing suicide. But as with every other theory so far, there's nothing to prove it. There's a startling lack of evidence here, and that makes everything possible. Now, if it wasn't a stranger, could it have been someone he knew and trusted? Many people, including Brian's friends and family, believe that his best friend, Clint Florence, knows more about what happened that night than he's saying. Brian spent the bulk of his evening with Clint, with the two moving up and down the street that night, hitting several bars before they ran into Meredith Reed, who gave them a lift back to the Ugly Tuna. Surveillance cameras confirm their presence there, and later show both Clint and Reed exiting without Brian. It isn't impossible to lose a friend when you're out partying. I've certainly been separated from friends when we've been out to a busy place. On the other hand, I also try to find my friends and don't like the idea of leaving if I don't know where they went. It's a lot easier today, everyone's got a cell phone, but 2006 wasn't that long ago, and Brian definitely had a cell phone on him that night. Leaving your friend behind doesn't make you a murderer, but it's something I would try real hard to not do. In the 2 days before police were contacted, everyone involved has said that Clint was extremely helpful and cooperative. He was trying to locate Brian, like everyone else, and had committed his time and energy to the process. Allegedly, it was when police became involved that Clint chose to cut communication and hire a lawyer. Many view this as a suspicious act, and even for me, I admit it's hard to not see it that way, but we don't know what police said to him. If they hinted early on that they suspected him of something, then he was intelligent to hire a lawyer, even if he played no role in the disappearance. I know that if I were questioned tomorrow for a crime I did not commit, I'd answer to a point, but if I began to feel like they were looking for something to try and corner me, I'd absolutely hire an attorney. Any attorney will tell you it's just a smart move, and hell, most attorneys will tell you not to answer even the most simple and inane questions without having representation. Is that enough to condemn Clint? I don't think so. It's very easy to say that Brian was Clint's best friend and he should have been more willing to help, and I totally agree with that. But I also believe that there may be more to his reason for lawyering up than we have said, to a point. When it was later revealed that not only did he sever his communication with police, but also with Brian's friends and family, that threw up red flags for me, because I can't know for sure whether he did that by choice or if he was directed to do so by his lawyer. Multiple people in this case submitted voluntarily to a polygraph. Brian's father and Meredith Reed did, we know for sure, and both passed. At a minimum, that tells me that if Clint played a role in what happened that night, Reed was unaware and certainly didn't participate. Considering Clint left with Reed that night, that makes things a little more complicated. I don't really blame Clint for not doing the polygraph. As I've said in several episodes in the past, there isn't much benefit. They're inaccurate and undependable. They're so inaccurate and inexact that they aren't even admissible in court. So what does that tell you? If you refuse to take one, you look guilty. If you take one, it could say you're guilty whether you are or not. If you pass one, it can't be used in your defense should you be arrested and go to trial. I can't say whether or not I would have taken a polygraph in Clint's position, but I think I'd want to do everything to help my friend. The question about Clint really is, did he play a role in making Brian disappear, or did he assist Brian in pulling off a vanishing act? There's been rumor and speculation that Clint was in the drug business and that Brian, at a minimum, knew about it and at a maximum was involved in it. I don't see a lot of evidence to support this theory, but a lot of people believe this created some kind of tension between the two and Clint wanted to eliminate Brian. It's possible, but again, we've got nothing in black and white to lend credence to this claim. Now, if there were any tensions and both men were drunk, it isn't impossible to see that something could have happened leading to Brian being killed, whether it had been on purpose or accidentally. The problem is, can you guess? Where is his body and how was it hidden or removed from the bar? Clint Florence doesn't strike me as a criminal super genius, so I doubt he'd have some way to eliminate Brian that night, but to also leave the bar and be captured on surveillance footage not looking the least disheveled or like he'd been in any kind of a struggle. Could Clint have played a role in the alleged death of Brian Schaefer? Absolutely. But again, we have nothing to support this theory. So what about the other side of the coin? Could Clint in some way have facilitated Brian's choosing to vanish? Maybe. If indeed Brian wanted to escape that night and assuming he were aware of the surveillance cameras, it isn't entirely impossible to believe that Clint could have brought something with him, a hat, a shirt, something which would allow Brian to leave unnoticed by the cameras. Even the police have theorized Brian could have changed his clothes that night. For me, it comes down to motive, the why, and the how. Could you help your best friend run off and then lie to his family, his girlfriend, and the police without feeling guilty? Also, when you know this case is slowly turning into a homicide investigation and that the police consider you a person of interest, isn't it more important to tell the truth? Especially if it's as banal as Brian running away, rather than facing the possibility of being arrested for murder? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And sadly, if it comes down to a choice here, I'd have to say if Clint was involved, I think it's more likely he was party to a murder, rather than someone who helped his best friend run away. But considering the lack of evidence, that is little more than speculation on my part and the part of many others who have dug into this case. What happened to Brian Schaefer in the early morning hours of April 1st, 2006? We may never know. This is by far one of the most disturbing and mystifying cases I've ever covered. I've been following it since nearly the beginning, and it continues to baffle me today. It's like a vicious cycle. The deeper you dig into it, the less it feels like you really know. I don't know what happened to Brian Schaefer, and I have such a huge amount of empathy for his family and friends. I can't begin to imagine what it was like for them when he disappeared, nor how every day since has been yet another one where some part of you, no matter how small, must still harbor hope that one day an answer will be found. If still alive, Brian Schaefer would be 38 years old. He's been missing for over 11 years. Maybe someday this riddle will have an answer, and peace and closure can be brought to the sole surviving brother, Derek, and those who have searched for him over all these years. Maybe someone out there has the answers, and we can only hope that that person comes forward and puts an end to this utterly baffling case. If you're interested in finding more information about the disappearance of Brian Schaefer, there are many websites and news stories about it. The family has set up findbrianschaefer.com, where there is a lot of details about his disappearance. If you have more information about the disappearance of Brian Schaefer, please contact the Columbus Police Department or the FBI. What do you believe happened to Brian Schaefer? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. If you'd like to support Trace Evidence, please visit the Patreon page located at patreon.com/traceevidence. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence and invite you to check out our website at trace-evidence.com. You can find links to the Patreon, social media accounts, as well as places to go to download the podcast and subscribe. I'm always eager to hear your feedback. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a good rating on iTunes and leave us a review. This will greatly help our reach and bring more attention to the cases I cover. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved crime on the next episode of Trace Evidence. I'm going to leave you with a promo for another true crime podcast I've recently discovered that I think you might enjoy.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Samantha.
And we're the hosts of True Crime Storytime, a podcast for all things true crime.
We will be bringing you fortnightly episodes covering everything from murder and mysteries, disappearances, theft and fraud,
abductions and kidnappings, and more importantly, trying to take a lesson away from each case, because every story has a message.